I'm Larkin Kemp.
Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I'm Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. And unfortunately, we don't know where Larkin Kemp is. We do not have a Brown loss to explain for this one. He may or may not pop in. That has been a theme of this podcast over the course of the season. But either way, we are going to react to what was an unbelievable Cornell run to an NCAA championship, a memorable 2025 NCAA tournament. And we're going to get into some of the recent news, particularly in the transfer portal and coach carousel worlds. Nick, when we did our recap shows last year, we did a two-parter, and I'm kind of thinking we'll do that again. So we'll come back one more time next week. We'll make it a little bit more of a season-long superlatives. If you've got an amuse-bouche of superlatives that you would like to sprinkle throughout the episode, feel free. But generally speaking, that's the main course that we are going to save for next week. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing wonderful. Got a dinner party tonight. Got the focaccia dough in the fridge. Hand rolling a quarter mile of pasta today. And this is something that some listeners, particularly Connor Frazina, Jamie Iketa, Mike Hernandez, some of the old Outlaws guys, they knew that this was a staple of when I was living in Denver. Was you just text me if you're coming to dinner on Sunday. And now this will be kind of the first chance to replicate it in Boise. So this whole episode, I'm going to be tapping my toes. I'm in a great mood. Entry price is a bottle of wine. We take care of the rest, and it's one of my favorite things to do. And we're finally replicating it here in Boise. So I'm on cloud nine. And, you know, 10 minutes before the episode, kind of everything that you're thinking about crystallizes into like kind of a more clear path of what you want to hit on. The only thing that I kept going back to was, you've been doing it longer than me. I've been doing it a little bit. This year was just an awesome year. You know, we're going to talk about what our favorite game was, individual performances, do a little bit of a recap. And there were so many moments. It's one of those episodes where I know someone's going to be like, how did you not include insert game that they had a personal tie to? No offense to anybody here. There's just a lot to go on this year. It seems like it was a better year than some that we've covered in the past. Maybe that's just recency bias.
When we kicked this thing off in January, one of the things we talked about was basically COVID year of eligibility was done and there were no super teams. And what's interesting, and I think this is a nice segue into talking about Cornell's NCAA tournament run in a little bit more totality. I think, you know, last week we went live immediately after the game was over and really focused on the national championship game. I think that, you know, it was kind of sitting right beneath our nose. Cornell kind of was a super team. They and Penn, I think, relative to the rest of the Ivy League, had done the best job of guys withdrawing in order to maintain their eligibility. And so there were a ton of guys who were, you know, five or 6 years out of high school. And, you know, Michael Long and CJ Kirst were two of the most substantial. And it's not to suggest that there was anything untoward or unfair about it, but I think that the notion that there was no super team was maybe a little bit misleading because the Big Red didn't bring in grad transfers to bolster what was already a very good group. And as a result, that was kind of the label that we had created, whether it was for Notre Dame or Maryland or whomever. And so, I think as I think back on this Cornell team, I think that their veteran experience, and it's particularly interesting insofar as, you know, this wasn't a team that had made a deep run into the NCAA tournament either of the last 2 years. And so it wasn't as if the sophomores and juniors who were contributors could rely on that experience. But, you know, the likes of Long and Kirst and Hugh Kelleher and a bunch of others did make it to a Final Four in 2022. And so whether it was a Team of Destiny component or that veteran experience, I think that was ultimately really foundational to why this group was able to get over the hump. 48 years, man, is remarkable for a program that I believe won three in the first six years that there was an NCAA tournament. So really happy for all the Cornell alums. I'm sure that they've had a great week celebrating.
And speaking of, you know, a great performance by Cornell, this is going to be a great performance by me because I actually have to start this podcast off with a public apology that I promised I would give. Chase Erland. So TD put me in a group chat with him and Chase. If you don't know the Erlands, you're probably listening to the wrong podcast. But he goes, Nick, Chase has something to tell you. Chase responds, do you remember in January of 2021 when I told you CJ Kearse would win the Tewarton and you laughed at me? My response was, no, you could be standing right next to me and I wouldn't know who you are. The tough part about being famous is that every one of my friends, Pud Dick Younger Brothers, comes up and gives 55 predictions. Inevitably, when one of them is right, it's her der, remember when I called it. Little aggressive in defending myself there, but it got two ha-has. And then I told him that I would publicly apologize and tell the listeners that Chase Erland of the Redwoods said that CJ Kearse would win the Tewarton in 2021, and he's been pretty adamant about it. So, end up, you got me.
All right, I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to take a victory lap, and Jamie Monroe can be my source of confirmation because, you know, it was probably around the time that you reported that Jeff Teat was transferring to Denver. We talked about how lamentable it was that Cornell hadn't been able to capitalize on Teat's virtuoso-ness in terms of postseason success. And I was like, all right, small consolation, but I actually think CJ Kearse is going to be just about as good as Jeff Teat. And he was aghast. He was like, that is blasphemous and insane. And I was like, okay, we'll see. And ultimately, here we are. So me and Chase Erland, we are leading the charge of defending CJ Kearse's honor in 2021 and 2022.
And again, I didn't say anything bad about it. I think it was more just, you're the younger brother in this dynamic, so whatever you say is going to be wrong. And then I think he's been waiting, yeah, a good 4 years to be like, hey, Nick, because as soon as the game ended, hey, remember when? And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Like, you've just been waiting and being patient. So credit to Chase and credit to you.
So I think there's been a lot said about that end of the field for the Big Red. And one of the big news items of the week was Jordan Stevens, the defensive coordinator, stepping down. It was crazy because when McAneer and I were and Dan Abram were walking out of Gillette Stadium, my comment was, we have to do something about Jordan. If you don't remember, when Pete Milliman left to take the Johns Hopkins head coaching job, Jordan was named the interim. And my sense is that the reason that that was the case is because I think he was considered to be the number one assistant. And I think that was more a reflection of the fact that Pete was a offense first coach, right? And so typically you kind of orient it where your number one assistant is more defensive oriented. And then your number two assistant would probably be the one that would support your end of the field. And so the fact that then Connor Busick got named the head coach and his college teammate was gracious, and I would use the word magnanimous enough to just continue forging ahead and very clearly not let it affect his approach to the job, I think is really notable. And, you know, we went over to the tailgate to say hello to some folks, and he was the first person that we saw. And, you know, I think we had just finished recording, and I was really interested in why they made the matchup decisions that they did, specifically putting Brennan Staub on Eric Spanos, because I thought that if you looked at the Penn State matchup, you know, it was really Jason Singer guarded Matt Traynor, Staub guarded Kyle Lehman. Traynor is the bigger, stronger of the two. Lehman is the quicker, faster. I didn't realize how close in height Staub and Singer are, or close in size. They're both listed at 6'1", Singer's listed at 215. Staub is listed at 210. And what Jordan said was Staub prefers those physical matchups. And that was why they made the decision. He wants to bang. And it was interesting because, again, I said this last week, but on the first two real Spanos dodges, he put his shoulder into Staub and moved him feet backwards. And I was like, if I were you, that would have made me nervous. Just because, you know, is that... That's a core aspect of how you want that matchup to go if you're Spanos and Maryland as an offensive coordinator. You want to be able to use that size. He's 6'5", 220 pounds, in order to convert it into power, in order to get to the spot where he wants to get to. But ultimately, nothing good came of it. in those instances. And ultimately, he finished with 2 goals and 2 assists, and he was coming off of being Maryland's leading scorer against Syracuse. And so, you know, certainly he was going to be at the top of the opposing scouting report. But both of those goals came after switches. And it was funny because when I said that to Jordan or started to make that point, he wasn't hearing it. And he just didn't even accept the premise. He was like, he was the best player on the field. And this was a game in which CJ Kerr scored 6 goals and was named the most outstanding player of the tournament. And so, you know, a day later when I was writing the Why Cornell Won piece, I wanted to include that anecdote. But, you know, I think he had a beer in his hand, and I'm very sensitive to the off the record distinctions of when the first beer has been cracked. So I just wanted to make sure that he was cool with that being out there. And he was like, yeah, man, I meant what I said. And so that was a day before the announcement came down that he was stepping away. And it's remarkable. We'll get into, you know, what seems like a trend of coaches leaving the profession that we've seen over the course of the last couple weeks here. But I think that it creates a really good avenue to talk about Cornell's defense. Was there anything that you noticed or picked up on about that end of the field for Cornell that you feel like didn't get the attention that it deserved either last week or prior?
Having gone back and rewatched the first 3 quarters, still have the 4th quarter to rewatch. But what impressed me the most was Cornell's defense, and it's clear when it's happening and it's clear when it's not, but it's almost difficult to recognize in game, is the contrast between the recognition of the individual matchup and what the supporting roles are doing. And the adjacent players for Cornell did a fantastic job, because Spanos, when he gets a full head of steam, is going wherever he wants. You know, he's one of those very difficult players to stop. Even if you're in front of him, he just has that leg drive where he can get to his spots, like few other players on Maryland or throughout the country can. And so what really impressed me the most was the adjacent players for Cornell recognizing that this was the individual matchup of the day, and they were going to make or break their win or loss by the shot selection and the quality of release in particular, saying, we don't think that Maryland is going to be able to truly take advantage of some of the off-ball players if we bring the correct amount of pressure with the individual matchup, and if we don't let that individual matchup materialize into any momentum, whether it's right or left. And so to give your dog the number one player on the other team, but to also have the rest of the defense being cognizant of that matchup being the make or break, let's shut this down and let's see what else they can throw at us. You know, let's see what kind of day our goalie's having in the net. Let's do a first and second quarter of executing beautifully so that we can make adjustments at halftime. And ultimately, I think, you know, that collective awareness is really the term I kept going back to, was that everybody was on the same page, that initial hedge to whatever way he dodged, and then the backside getting ready for a quick rotation, jamming up space in the middle, kind of packing it in a little bit more tight. It was beautifully executed. And, you know, again, when you have Cornell's offense, I feel like that's more fun to watch, and it's obviously more talked about. But, you know, defense wins championships too. And this Cornell team, I feel, was the most self-aware team, I would say, of anyone in the country. Like, when the defense was giving up runs, and they gave up many runs throughout the season, essentially they just, I would assume, had in the back of their mind, like, guys, our offense is going to win this game for us. All we have to do is give them that chance. Like, let's button up these 2 or 3 issues, and let's get the offense the ball so that they can do what they do. I feel like they had their blueprint for success early on in the season, and the Maryland's, the Notre Dame's, even to some extent the Ohio State's, the Penn State's, they had to tinker with and make adjustments throughout the end of the year, and Cornell just stayed true to who they were. And so I think, you know, ultimately by the end of the, you know, by Memorial Day and throughout the playoffs, Cornell just had the luxury of relying and having played a similar type of game over and over and over again. And that comfortability was too much for Maryland to overcome.
No, it sets up the point that I want to make perfectly, because over the last 2 years, I've drawn comparisons between Yale and Cornell, because in 2024, Both teams were top five offenses, and Yale was a 60 plus faceoff team, and both teams were ranked in the 30s from a defensive efficiency standpoint. And you know, my contention was that Cornell is a 60% faceoff team as long as Jakus Gadden is playing, and he got hurt either in their first game or the week after their first game last season and missed the rest of the year. And so my point was, I think that it is a reasonable formula to win a national championship to be a top 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 offense that's facing off at 60% with a defense that, and that's why I kind of lay out the, if you have the number one offense by a considerable margin, then your defense can probably get by being between 20 and 25. You know, if you're kind of in the mix of the top five offenses, right? Like a Harvard or whatever, you probably need to be in the like 15 to 20 range. And so what we were talking about from the standpoint of Yale and Cornell defensive improvement was both marginal and attainable. And I think that was why it felt realistic for really both of those teams ultimately. And that's why I kept making the point over the course of the year, like Yale's issues were at the offensive end, right? Like they need to be, like they were obviously not good defensively. And that's another element that we're going to talk about when it comes to assistant coaching moves, but the strength that they were supposed to be able to rely on was not there. It was not present. Whereas for Cornell, I mean, you know, Notre Dame was the number one offense last year in 2024. And Cornell ended up being the number one offense this year by the same margin that separated 2 from 9. And so, you know, the gap between 1 and 2 was the same as the gap between 2 and 9. So they were the best offense by a mile. Their defense ended up at 21. And that improvement from mid-30s, I believe they were 35, might have been as low, I think Yale was 38, to 21 is that is the path to winning a championship. And I think that there's a lot of credit that should go to the group. One of the things that is so maddening about analyzing defense in lacrosse is separating the quality of defensive play from the quality of goaltending. And so last year, Cornell didn't really know who their goalie was. They, you know, basically played Wyatt Nost, who ended up winning the starting job this year, as well as, you know, a highly recruited freshman. And then this year they brought in another highly recruited player or highly ranked player in Timmy Piacentini. And so the question, I guess the point I would make is this, is like, did the defense get that much better or did they just get solid goalie play? But I think that creates a natural follow-up, which is, was the goalie play better because the defense in front of it was more consistent and better? And it's an unanswerable question, but again, I think it deserves a lot of, I think everybody deserves a lot of credit. Wyatt Nost, Jason Singer, Brennan Staub, Matt Dooley, Walker Wallace, Walker Schwartz, I thought Luke Gilmartin, number 77, the Schuster team, was one of the most improved players over the course of the year. I thought that he did that really important role of being both reliable on ball while also being the playmaker. His goose to that ended the semifinal, I thought, was one of the, you know, kind of unsung awesome plays of the year. And so Chris Davis has been one of my favorite players over the last 3 years. He's struggled through a tremendous number of injuries, and the list goes on and on. So I just want to make sure that those boys get their due.
Yeah, and one of the things that I like to notice as far as is it good goaltending or is it good defense is when a shot goes in, the immediate 3 second reaction after that, and drawing on, you know, Notre Dame's experience last year, you know, there were good shots that Entman was like, yo, that's on me, like we want to give that up. And it seemed like Cornell had a pretty good balance of every time a goal was scored, there was kind of the immediate recognition of like, hey, keep giving that up. Like we want to have those shots taken, or the defense going over to Nuss and saying like, yo, that's our bad. We'll take care of, you know, whatever it was, whether it was off ball movement and, you know, a crease shot is obviously one that you want to take away, but some of those mid range, you know, questionable angles, it kind of always seemed that the first 3 seconds after Nust went and raked it, there was immediate recognition and alignment with, do we want to keep giving that up versus do we need to make adjustments defensively? And that, I think that's a trickier topic than a lot of people might recognize. Goalies, A, are psychos. We all know that. But B, like, even throughout the game, they can get comfortable seeing the ball from different angles. Like, yep, a shot that you were comfortable giving up last week, there might be a release point or something in the background or something that is just off about the goalie from that specific location that day. Particularly low angles in championship weekends was a discussion that we had where, hey, we're not necessarily used to having, you know, crowds or, you know, that specific light, or, you know, you're playing in an NFL stadium and there might be, you know, a weird collection of whatever it might be, that kind of messes up. So even reflecting back, you know, when we were playing DU, at the link, there was a conversation I had with Connor Kelly after we had given up a goal. And he's like, guys, not really anybody's fault, but those low angle shots where we were wearing white and, that would have been opposite of the scoreboard. He was like, when they take low angle shots and we have our bench in the background, like, I'm not seeing the ball. And so it kind of seemed like Cornell was able to figure that out quickly and make adjustments with, you know, again, you win or you learn. And if you lose on a 6-on-6 possession where they get a goal, Cornell did a really good job all being on the same page.
Oh, yeah. CJ Kearse won the Tewarton. And then he went on the injured reserve for PLL and is out, I believe, at least the first 4 weeks. You know, we speculated about his injuries last week. I think this is confirmation that he is not healthy. And, you know, I don't know that we necessarily need to go much more into Monday's performance, but I think in light of the confirmation of the injury news, it bears repeating how impressive it was for his teammates to pick up the slack on Saturday. And obviously, you know, you had two guys score 10 of their 13 goals against Maryland, but against Penn State, you know, it was the depth of scoring in an 11-9 outcome. Michael Long was obviously great. Hugh Kelleher was great. But, you know, Staub had a goal and an assist. Firth had a goal and an assist. Brian Luzzi, Ryan Waldman, Ryan Sheen had an assist. And Kaskaden scored a goal. So for Goldstein and Kearse to get held to just one goal, no assists, is remarkable. And then obviously for them to then turn around and score 10 on Monday, incredible. Nick, knowing what you do about these two games in 3 day situations, the stakes and pressure of the biggest stage, what do you have to say about that with respect to just how impressive it is for those teammates to step up, and then also for the Stars to then show up on Monday, especially one that was, you know, obviously dealing with a ton of physical issues?
I mean, could go a million different directions, but I'm starting to worry that, you know, the curse of the Tewarton just means you have to win a national championship, you know, dragging your body through the finish line. Curse this year, Kavanaugh last year. So goes without saying, but, you know, and I think you mentioned it in our text thread with Larkin. But I think one of the most important attributes a star player has is the ability to play through pain, or, you know, are you hurt or are you injured? And even if you're injured, you're still gonna, your number's still gonna get called in the biggest stage, because guess what? You didn't put in all this work just to come out and say, oh, well, you know, I have X injury. Looks like I'm not playing in the national championship. Nobody who has achieved a high level of sport is wired that way. In regards to the arrival, and I can't speak for Cornell, but having talked to, you know, a number of buddies that, you know, now they were enemies on Final Four and now they're good friends of mine.
Yeah.
It kind of ended up being the, we don't care. Like, there, we have star power, but guess what? This is going to be a team that can eliminate our star power. So again, using my experience, and I'll use Denver again, or even Duke in the national championship, both losses. So maybe this isn't the best advice, but it kind of ended up being, hey, Nick, or insert player, Jim Marlott, or whoever it might be. Yes, we have Kavanaugh, we have Perkovic, but those are going to be the top two guys. You guys get ready for a big game if they're, you know, playing these aggressive doubles or whatever it might be. And it kind of elevated everybody's your number could get called. And that's why I think, you know, Cornell with their, we'll call it balanced offense. And I don't mean that in the sense that, oh, they were relying on everybody all year, because some games Curse just took over and there was nothing anybody can do to stop it. But what impressed me most about Cornell all season long was that if one door was closed on their offense, another one was opened. Particularly with how the attackmen play with each other, they can play a bruising game, they can play a two-man game, they can play slip picks, they can play off ball, they can hang you up. And when you have to put so much attention to that attack, like, it is going to benefit everybody on the team. And the skip passes they were finding against Penn State, and the way that the middies could initiate, and if they got a step, that slide would be late, because Penn State putting such a premium on shutting off the two most productive players. Again, the one door closes, one opens, and it's really nice. And I would assume that Kirst was thinking this the entire time against Penn State, where he's like, it's nice to have the depth that probably hasn't been talked about all year. Totally. It's really nice to have the teammates that he's seen every day in practice. Like, the level of comfortability that you get with your teammates, and KYP knowing your own personnel and being comfortable with, I know that this midfielder that has been mentioned three times all season can make this play about 90% of the time. Again, it goes back to, in the same way that the defense was self-aware, I think that Cornell's offense did a remarkable job of, every time they faced a wall, they just seemed to know how to get through it. And everybody was on the same page. It wasn't one person recognizing that they have to take over. It was, hey, I'm being shut out of the game. You know, they score a goal, the offense huddles, and they're like, let's keep doing that until they make an adjustment. Kind of a little bit of a scramble-brained answer, but
I enjoyed it. But it is a nice opportunity to transition to talking about the tournament more broadly. I think 25 minutes is a sufficient amount to talk about the 2025 national champions. So one more time, congrats to Connor Busick and the Big Red. When you think about the 15 or 17, if you want to include the play-in game tournament, what stands out in your memory as the best game?
I mean, the low-hanging fruit, and I wouldn't be surprised if you're going to agree with me, but Princeton-Syracuse, best tournament game in recent memory. And a couple reasons why I think that. A, again, the easy answer is, like, if you aren't a lacrosse fan and you watch that, you would just have your jaw on the ground. In the same way that I've never played hockey in my life, but, you know, when I watch a breakaway goal where somebody goes between the legs, I'm like, holy moly. I don't know how much skill that takes, but I just know I watched something special. It seemed like every goal that was scored, if you don't have a lacrosse eye, you could just recognize that was something special. And it would almost ruin a lot of other lacrosse games, because you're like, oh, why isn't everybody else doing around the worlds and behind the backs and yeah, you know, ridiculous stuff all game long? But even more than that, I was worried going into the game that the narrative of two high-octane offenses and the buildup surrounding both of them could have left kind of like a sour taste if it was just kind of a standard game. But the high expectations, to me, were blown out of the water. And again, I was in Louisville at a bachelor party surrounded by 50% non-lacrosse players, but enough to warrant it being on the TV. And by the fourth quarter, you know, start of the fourth quarter, everybody was kind of just sitting around having a beer going, what are we watching right now? So that to me is not just, you know, game of the tournament, but, you know, certainly up there for game of the year. And who Syracuse Cornell last year off the faceoff, if that game didn't happen, I would put Cornell Princeton or Syracuse Princeton this year as like one of the best games I've seen in the last 2-3 years.
Yeah, it is interesting how much I don't know, the same teams are playing in the best games, because while I'm not going to argue that Syracuse Harvard was a better game, I am going to make it my answer for the sake of diversity on this podcast. And it was obviously a much different game insofar as, you know, where there was a little bit more nip and tuck and back and forth in Princeton Syracuse. Obviously, this was just a enormous comeback for the Orange. I think that, you know, obviously Harvard had won in the Dome in the regular season. and there was conversation about the worthiness of their NCAA tournament selection, especially relative to Army. And so I think that with both of those, there was this tension as to, you know, how are they going to comport themselves? Were they, and, you know, to what degree were they an underdog, whatever? Like, is there blowout potential? And so, you know, for Harvard to come out and build the lead that they did that looked increasingly sustainable as the first half went along is probably the way that I would put it. I thought that they were clamping down so hard defensively, and they were playing so hard defensively, and, you know, Graham Stevens was backing them up in goal, that it didn't feel like either they were asking too much of their offense or that their offense wasn't really even going to be able to continue to provide it, particularly because, you know, they were getting contributions from all over. It wasn't as if they were specifically relying on a Jack Spiedel or Sam King explosion. And so, you know, ultimately, I guess the reason that it shouldn't be the answer is because, you know, the game hinged on a non-releasable penalty that was a penalty, whether or not it should have been non-releasable and how it was otherwise adjudicated. And then some of the calls that came afterwards are certainly debatable. But the reason that I think that doesn't undermine its case for being the best game of the tournament is because Harvard still, they got back, right? And that Owen Gaffney goal in transition to send the game to overtime with like 2 seconds left was the absolute just pinnacle of drama. And ultimately it ended with Syracuse winning in overtime. And Owen Hiltz was the hero from the game winner standpoint. But that is going to be a game that over the course, you know, the depths of August, when we are about as far away from college lacrosse as we otherwise would be, I'm going to go back and turn that one on.
And if we rewind the tapes, I was doing a deep investigative dive into Ghetto Gary Gates' Instagram last night. Funny troll account, you know, probably an idiot, but good humor. He rewound the tapes, and when Harvard played Syracuse earlier this year and Harvard won, Coach Byrne afterwards was saying Syracuse is a Final Four team. And he was kind of getting clowned on by the people that are paying attention to college lacrosse, because they were like, wow, Harvard gets their, you know, win at Syracuse, and then Jerry Byrne is immediately trying to bolster Syracuse's resume by saying they're a Final Four team immediately after the victory. Seems convenient. So if we're talking about just desserts, you know, Coach Byrne, who of course I've been accused of being too big of a fan of on this podcast, by Max Adler, but he was right on that one. So Max, maybe it's time that you give Coach Byrne an apology, because he nailed the call right after the game.
Any individual performances stand out in your memory that you feel like deserve additional spotlight or didn't get enough shine in the moment?
I would put Little John's season performance up there. God, I knew you were going to do it. But with the way that he helped, you know, helped win against UNC, you know, with everything that Richmond accomplished, and we, I'll say we, but I kind of started paying attention to them a little bit late. I was like, oh, they're kind of the sleeping giant, but, you know, they'll probably wash out, get smoked in the first round. Heading into the tournament, I think everybody was on the same page that even though they're playing at UNC, this is like a different Richmond. This isn't the one that we've looped in all year with, you know, High Point and Jacksonville. Is, yeah, they might get one, but at the end of the day, Richmond is just going to Richmond, and, you know, they'll say that they had a good season after getting blown out by an ACC opponent. And the way that Little John would score 5 goals with holding the ball in his stick for 5 seconds total, you just can't stress the importance of a player like that. And even when UNC or insert any of his opponents were giving him the attention that he deserved, his ability to do that with pressure on his hands or catching a ball on the crease, you know, as everybody is collapsing. And maybe it's just because it was an area of my game that I just could never, ever figure out. But like the importance of having a player like that and what I think he could do to the trajectory of Richmond in the next 5 years. So I'll give him a shout out for UNC game, but I would like to give him kind of a couple shout outs, you know, over the course of the season.
Yeah. No, I'm glad that you took that answer. I've got three that I want to shine a spotlight on. First, Aiden Carroll's 6-goal, 2-assist performance against Duke. Just one of the most incandescent that you can imagine a team going, or a player, excuse me, going. Would be the most incandescent, except for Matt Traynor's performance against Notre Dame in the quarterfinals. In that,
No, we can't say that one.
I'm going to say something nice about Notre Dame. Thomas Richardelli's performance against Ohio State and the way in which it just rendered kind of, you know, what was otherwise a pretty potent Ohio State offense through the course of the season, kind of rudderless, was really remarkable. But the one that I want to point out that I think is very liable to get lost in kind of the memory of this postseason was Penn State against Colgate. And I think there are two areas. Well, I don't know. So Reed Gills, the freshman faceoff guy, deserves a lot of credit. But at the same time, you know, high scoring game, ton of faceoffs. It's not an area of strength for Colgate. So going to mitigate that a little bit. Liam Matthews, I felt like, was a player that Penn State doesn't win that game without, because there were points where their offense looked very stagnant and like they didn't have a ton of ideas, and it felt like Liam Matthews bailed them out. But ultimately, I think, you know, I just want to give a ton of credit to the middle of the field players for Penn State, because that it's kind of a weird, like, beat you at your own game situation. We've talked so much about Colgate this year in the context of how unique what they want to do is and how difficult it is to potentially prepare for and everything that goes along with that. And so when you just look at the numbers that Brendan Leary and John King put up from a ground ball and a cause turnover standpoint, combined with Ryan O'Connor, the long stick midi, I'm looking at it now. So those three guys combined to pick up 11 ground balls and cause 7 turnovers. And again, Colgate is willing to forego a lot in the clear and early offense in order to get it back in the ride. But one of the challenges is that if you are not able to take advantage of the recklessness and the willingness to make mistakes in the clear, then that's how you kind of get subsumed by the tidal wave. And so you need your rope unit to be guys who can take advantage of that. And, you know, it was a 2-goal game for a team that ultimately made it back to the Final Four. If it goes the other way, not only do we have another Cinderella to compliment Richmond, but also, you know, how are we thinking about Jeff Tambroni legacy questions, all that sort of thing. And so just a really significant outcome. And I think that, you know, those four guys, Matthews in terms of bailing out the offense when it wasn't working early, and then the rope unit for taking advantage of what Colgate gives you in order to get what they want at the other end, I feel like it is really important to spotlight.
And I'll give two more, kind of one coming off of that Richmond comment, but low-hanging fruit, but Aiden McGuire's performance against Richmond in the middle of the season was it actually had me discounting Richmond, because I was like, there's no way that a short stick D-Mitty could have this good of a game against an elite opponent. Little did I know, I was just watching a generational short stick D-Mitty against a quality opponent. So, you know, his performance against Richmond were, you know, in a pretty star-studded lineup in retrospect, for him to stand out kind of among the rest was nothing short of remarkable. And then, actually, there are a couple performances, but Dartmouth's game against Princeton is one that I watched pretty closely earlier this year. Mason Morrell, the goalie for Dartmouth, put on an unbelievable performance. And, you know, earlier in the year, we were kind of talking about Dartmouth and their upward trajectory and how they stood toe-to-toe with, you know, Harvard, Princeton, and Cornell, three all-class teams. And Dartmouth was right on the cusp of a lot of those games. And I think Mason Morrell certainly was a reason. And in those three performances, but particularly the one against the high-powered Cornell or Princeton offense, you could just interchange so many Ivies. The high-powered insert Ivy League offense. But his game against Princeton, and I think he held them to 10. And it wasn't because they were taking away, you know, Mackesy's shots. It was because Morrell was standing tall. And that actually was sneaky, really, really good game.
All right, let's open up the aperture a little bit, talk about the NCAA transfer portal, which opened for undergrads to go in, I believe, on May 11th. It was whatever the Monday after, so basically a week after Selection Sunday was, and it closes in 10 days, basically. Grad students can go in whenever, and in terms of the kind of high-level or high-profile activity that we've seen so far, I think, you know, just as a reminder, Yale, the Yale grad students are probably, you know, as a storyline, that's the biggest group, so to speak, that went in so far. And we knew that, Chris Lyons and Leo Johnson, the righty lefty attack pair, had made the decision before the season to go to Maryland. Shortly on the heels of the end of that, we learned that, a reserve defender, Jake Cohen decided to go to Ohio State. This week, we learned that starting defenseman Mikey Alexander is going to join Leo and Lyons at NBA Terp. So that was one of the bigger kind of elements or items of the early part of this past week. In addition, one of the more high-profile undergrads that was in there was Matt Lazaro, who is a highly ranked recruit coming out and was at Penn State. He is going to go to Providence. On top of that, later this week, and I guess more recently, a couple of relatively well-known names, Maryland attackman Elliot Dubik, who's a man-up specialist, and Penn State face-off guy Chase Mullins, both entered as grad students. Will Tominovich, a starting defenseman from Georgetown, is going to Michigan as a grad student. Henry Blake, grad student, goalie from Ohio State, is going to Duke. And more recently, Aiden Murnane, a defender for Colgate, who we just kind of talked about, is going to Virginia. And Shorsick Dimity, Dante Bowen, another grad student from Ohio State, is going to Syracuse. Nick, overall, do you have a reaction to any of this movement that we've seen so far?
No, I mean, I hate it. The easy joke to make is like, oh, wow, Tillman saw that what happens when you steal a bunch of Yale players that Coach Corrigan did, I think, 2 years ago.
Yep.
Oh, is Tillman even a good coach, or has he just been riding Corrigan's coattails, is a joke I've made to a couple of my Terp friends. But other than that, I mean, I got to be honest here. I kind of hate this time of year. You know, and whether
come on, man, it's clout chasing news breaking.
I know it's clout chasing news breaking, but with that being said, like I always liked, and one of my favorite part about you know, collegiate athletics was that there was continuity year over year with roster over roster. That sophomore that had a pretty good year, I wonder what he's going to be able to do as a junior. And you know, even viewing it through the lens of Notre Dame, who most certainly is going to benefit more from the transfer portal than be hurt by it. It's still like, I almost purposefully tune it out, which makes for a very bad podcast segment, but I kind of wait for all the dust to settle and then start accepting that, you know, this roster turnover and this, you know, game of pinball, is going to make me less excited for teams next year or more excited for teams next year. But until all of it settles, I kind of just go, wow, I'm just more curious about the contract sizes and, you know, why someone would go from Penn State to Providence if they had a promising, you know, spring. You know, why would you do this? Why would you do that? And then ultimately I decided, you know, trying to figure out the whys behind any situation are stupid. So I am a horrible co-host when it comes to transfer portal talk, other than just being a big old grumpy guy.
You did tee me up perfectly though. So just a couple of things, in terms of the guys who are in the portal that either have not yet made the decision or we don't know. So Liam Connor, an attackman from Colgate, has 2 years of eligibility left. His brother Rory, you know, they were their leading scorers, is a grad student going to Georgetown. It created the assumption that Liam was going to follow in his footsteps. That hasn't happened yet, at least to our knowledge. So that seems significant. On top of that, Henry Dodge, who has 1 year of eligibility left, is a nearly 70% faceoff guy from Vermont. Those are the two kind of most highly ranked, so to speak, non-grad students. And among the grad students, I should have mentioned Owen Gaffney, who we mentioned earlier with that remarkable game tying goal for Harvard, is going to Duke. Among the highly, you know, most kind of highly sought after guys who have not yet made a decision, Josh Yago, the attackman from Air Force, very unique circumstance where he is going to be able to go to grad school and play because he has a year of eligibility, despite and you know, kind of that'll be part of his service commitment. So really interesting there. Mason Oak, the goalie from Quinnipiac, and Brad Sharp, another Yale guy at Mitty. So those are five of the, you know, destinations that we'll be watching. But I actually have a take that I'm pretty excited about that is the exact opposite of your boring podcast comment.
Oh God, here we go.
There are, as of the, you know, basically 10 days ago, there were 225 Division I outbound players in the portal, meaning Division I players who had entered the portal to potentially find a new home or thereabouts. And of those, 60 to 70 were grad students, right? So now you're looking at, call it 150-ish undergrads. And of those 150, by a quick parsing, I'm going to say all but 25 didn't really contribute at their current institution. And so what that leads me to conclude is that's a relatively normal number. What we used to see is, you know, a recruiting class would be, call it 12, 13, whatever, and depending on the institution, and then eight of them would graduate. You know, that's a relatively normal retention number. And when I say graduate, I mean as a member of the team, not graduate from college. Because it's just a very hard lifestyle and commitment. And for a lot of guys who aren't getting on the field, the demands of what you put in are not worth the rewards. So you would typically see a lot of guys quit and either stay at their institution or transfer, not to play lacrosse somewhere else, but just transfer to be a student at a different school. And there was largely no record of it, and folks didn't pay very close attention to it. Now, it's so easy to enter the transfer portal, and that's kind of why the transfer portal exists, is to be easy, that you might as well put your name in there because you know you're not going to continue playing here, not because you don't have the opportunity to, because you don't want to, and see what shakes loose. And if nothing shakes loose, doesn't matter. There's no downside for you. So I think that that's what we're seeing in large part. But here's my spicy take. I think the NCAA transfer portal has reduced the likelihood and frequency of the best players at, call it, the mid-major institutions from leaving. And here's the reason why.
What a stupid thing to say. Continue.
In a pre-transfer portal era, you could, as a Division I coach who really liked a player like that, back channel through his club coach or his high school coach or whatever in order to say, if that player is interested in transferring, we are interested in having him at our school. Effectively encouraging that player to transfer. And if you're a coach at one of those programs, you would probably call it poaching off of your roster. And we saw a fair amount of that over the course of the 2010s, right? You know, Alex Woodall, I think, is a pretty prominent example of somebody who had a breakout freshman year at High Point and then transferred to Towson and ended up making it to the Final Four with the Tigers. You know, there are a handful of others, whether, you know, it was Chris Gray or T.D. Erlin, you know, that come to mind that basically, like, traded up in a program profile. I'm not saying that there was anything untoward done in those situations. I'm just saying that there was no open market whereby every college coach had the opportunity to get in touch with that player before he made a decision on where he was going to go. And so I think the incentive for, call it, the ACC or Big Ten coach to back channel and encourage a player to consider transferring is now almost gone, because once that player goes into the portal, everybody knows about it. And you have so much competition to get that player's services. And I think Liam Connor is a really good example of that. I think in a pre-transfer portal era, Liam Connor would already be at Georgetown. But because he goes into the portal and everybody has an opportunity to reach out to him, bring him in for a visit, create some sort of scholarship or NIL package that would be potentially more enticing than what he otherwise had heard. Now, all of a sudden, it's an open market. So why would you take the risk of, or do the work, even if it's not a risk, of having that player go into the portal only to then lose out to one of your competitors? It's better for you if that player stays at the mid-major, because either you don't have to play against him, or if you do have to play against him, at least you're doing it at an institution where you're going to be favored to win, as opposed to doing it at an institution in your league where maybe you're not favored to win. And so that's my argument for why I think that the portal has increased the likelihood and the frequency of the best players staying home. You know, I think a guy who kind of fits this profile is Fairfield defenseman Julian Radosic. You know, he had a great freshman season, and I can imagine the cynical lacrosse fan saying, I bet that guy's going to go in the portal and be gone and be playing somewhere else as a sophomore. Well, he didn't, and he had a great sophomore season for Fairfield, and Fairfield had a great campaign. And so, I could point to dozens others of those types of players who I think in some folks' conception of how the transactional nature of college sports is working right now would assume that they're going to go in, and ultimately they didn't. And that's why I think there has to be a reason for it, and I think that that is primarily the reason.
So to almost have an analogy, you're almost on the side that once NIL was kind of a level playing field for all college football programs, and then the SEC hasn't won a championship, your argument is, oh, it's actually evening out and benefiting everybody because it's not just, and
because
I don't
it's
want
transparent.
To use the term greasy, it's more transparent.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the SEC guys who would show up with a brown bag of cash are now in a waiting line at the bank to get their cashier's check to present to a recruit.
Perfect analogy. Absolutely. I didn't think you had it in you. Great job by you.
well, thank you. Set the bar.
You already
low,
admitted that you were going to be terrible during this segment, so you totally redeemed yourself.
But with that being said, do you, and now we can just kind of get to questions I'm going to ask you that have absolutely no definitive answer, but I have an idea of where they are in my head, and I'm curious where you think these ballpark percentages would. Using, the kid from Fairfield as an example. When he, mm-hmm. If he were to hit the transfer portal, I almost think you're thinking about it wrong from the influx in versus the interest out. Because if I was at a mid-major and I always wanted to go to, Princeton, Notre Dame, or Duke, we'll just use those three. Do you think that that outbound interest, like before hitting the transfer portal and just kind of waiting to see, like I'm more thinking of it from an athlete's, a student athlete's perspective, where if my name's hitting the transfer portal and I'm waiting for three names to call me, I'm absolutely going to, hey, thanks for the call, X. I wasn't looking at you. Thanks for the call, Y. I wasn't looking at you. But, oh my goodness, Donowski's interested. This is exactly what I wanted from the beginning. So I'm just kind of curious, like, I can justify your argument if the interest from the players isn't aligned with who's reaching out to them.
So I think the point is,
do you think someone's name hits the portal and they're just bombarded by everybody?
Yeah.
Like even the Dukes, the Notre Dames, the Cornells,
well,
the Maryland's.
I mean, I think that if they know who the player is and they know that they want to be a part of the program, yes. I don't think that if those schools have no interest, then they reach out. I think they know that that's misleading and not worth their time. But yeah, I mean, I think that so it's not dissimilar to September 1st in the normal recruiting cycle, in the sense that you don't know who's going to be interested in you. Now, obviously, it's different insofar as like you get to make an active choice about whether or not you make yourself available. Whereas on September 1st, everybody is available, right? But I think if your point is that I'm not going to go in because I don't want to deal with 77 inbound interest, I don't think that that's it. I think it's more about the loyalty internally, right? The, just to use the Radosic example again, like in Kevin Brown's profile of him earlier this year, you know, he said, this is the place that took a chance on me. And that's why I'm going to be loyal to this program. And I think that there's a lot of that. And it doesn't mean that there will be no exceptions. I think your point is well taken insofar as there's still 10 days of this thing left and it could change. But, you know, for me, the early returns, and they're not that early. I mean, we're more than 2/3 of the way through. School's over for most kids and they're back home for the summer. You know, if you were going to do it, you're probably already done it in most cases. To me, if this is a trend, then I think the trend is we're going to see a diminishing number of undergrads who have promising futures at their current programs try to trade up through the portal.
Yeah, and again, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, it's never a perfect system, but I'm assuming some of those back channels are still open where it's like, hey, I'm thinking about hitting the portal, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Very curious where NIL comes into play, because I would assume that, you know, some of the kids, like I would have gone, oh, I'm going to put my name in the portal and see if I can get a bag. And then when it's like, hey, we'll give you, you know, $5 and a Dr. Coat, you know, Dr. Pepper. Oh, well, that wasn't really what I was looking for. I guess I'll just stay.
That's where there is risk, because once you go into the portal, then your grant and aid becomes non-guaranteed. And so your coach can, you know, pull back your scholarship by virtue of going into the portal. And I think that, you know, it's kind of funny because I did hear, I think that this is like a relatively widespread rumor, that there's one prominent player who is waiting to put his name into the portal, depending on the outcome of the House settlement, ongoing litigation. And, you know, I would say to me, it's pretty clear that the House settlement is not going to provide clarity in the next 10 days. And so as a result, like, I don't think that's going to be able to be a consideration for this individual. You know, on the one hand, I understand it from a roster cap standpoint. If you go to a place and then all of a sudden you're in jeopardy of getting cut, that's not great. Now, I don't know that that's a realistic outcome. And I've already been dubious of the roster limits getting put into place in the first place. But then obviously there's other elements, including the NIL clearinghouse and the things that go along with that, whether or not collectives are going to be able to continue to provide the things that they have offered through recruiting or other types of inducements. So there's a lot to it, that we just don't know the answer to right now. And, you know, it's going to be a while, I think, before we do know the answers to it. So,
well, and I'm actually curious to get your thoughts on this as well. And from a recruiting standpoint, a not insignificant amount of athletes that not only am I working with in Idaho, but just, you know, whoever reaches out, usually I end up helping and overloading myself, but it's something I love to do. But particularly on the parents, and I don't like this mindset at all, but I don't know how much credibility I have to shut it down. Because everything is relatively new and I haven't gone through this process. And when I was coaching, you know, at Air Force, it was a whole different ball game. But a lot of the parents are saying, oh yeah, we'll commit to this, we'll call it middle to low tier D1 program, but he's going to have a good freshman year and then he'll just hit the transfer portal his sophomore year. And I'm like, wow, what a stupid thing to think about. But I'll give you a chance, Terry, as someone who I would put as a more expert in recruiting than myself. The parents that are listening in that are having those thoughts of, yeah, well, you know, he is going to here, but he's just going to spend a year or two and then, you know, build up his resume and then transfer to where he wants to once he hits the portal. And I keep telling them two things. I'm like, one, that's a very stupid way to make a college decision because you're putting athletics over the quality of education. And hate to say it, once you make the PLL, you know, what are you going to do for work? Take it from me. And then the second thing is, I say, you are going all in on a potential misfit. And guess what? There's a more than 70% chance your son is not going to establish his name in the first 2 years at whatever programs he's at to get any interest. He might not even play at this place that you say. And they go, yeah, but my son's different. So if you were talking to a parent that had that idea of good 2 years and then hit the transfer portal, what would you tell them?
You're wrong. And it's dumb. And I agree with Nick. And I think that it's a little different when you talk about it in the context of going through the recruiting process, basically like the placeholder commitment, where it's like, I'm going to commit to this institution, but ultimately I'm going to continue to be recruited and be open to being recruited. you know, that is a little slimy. Some folks would call it very slimy. I think that the coaches do it just about as often as the players do it. And so as a result, like, I don't think it's the slimiest thing in the world. But the idea that there are just going to be so many things that unfold that you can't predict or expect over the course of the time between when your child commits versus when this unforeseen future date, when he or she goes into the portal, that to have that expectation is so foolish. I think your point is
there's kind of one in particular that I might clip that, because I can't be like, hey, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life, and you should sit down and take a cold shower. But, you know, I say that, but I say it nicer.
The strongest point or factor that you didn't say, that I think the reason that it's dumb or that it's so unlikely to happen, is because, like, your child is going to like the college experience at the place that they go. Like, what is it? 85% of kids love college. I don't think that's a number that exists or a stat that's been studied, but, like, generally speaking, especially college athletes, like, it is so fun. Your teammates are going to be, you know, you're going to be in their wedding. They're going to be in your wedding. You're probably going to get into a relationship, and all of those gravitational bonds are going to decrease the likelihood that you're going to want to leave. And that's why I think if the point is that the parent isn't satisfied with the academic profile or the post-grad opportunities of the institution, I would just say, like, come to terms with that before your kid enrolls, because, you know, once he or she is there, the likelihood that they're going to want to move on is going to diminish pretty fast.
And thank you for saying that. And I keep going back to, I'm like, guess what? What if he finds a girlfriend a sophomore year and falls in love? You think he's transferring away? No.
100%.
What if he 100%. Gets hurt? Oh, nope. What if he loves everything about the school? Oh, nope. Like, just 1,000 different factors. So I'm glad that, you know, I almost just wanted different words to say. But, you know, sometimes I do get questions after this podcast drops where they're like, yeah, you know, blah, 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 transfer portal. And I'm like, no. Now I'm going to say, go back and listen to minute 58 onwards of this episode and realize how stupid it is to have that mindset as a parent, instead of just saying, hey, man, it's your decision. Like, go and love the 4 years. And if you hit the transfer portal, why not?
Sure.
So many parents are getting too involved. If you're a parent, it's not your decision. You know, you should have a talk about the financial situation, but let the kid make his own call. Now I'm just ranting, but
let's finish with a quick conversation about the coaching carousel, because we teased it at the top. In chronological order from farthest to go to most recent, St. Bonaventure parted ways with Randy Mearns. They have not hired a replacement. Loyola parted ways with offensive coordinator Mark Van Arsdale. They have since hired Justin Ward from Army. Army backfilled him by promoting Rick Wagner. Hampton has not renewed Chaz Woodson, did not renew Chaz Woodson as its head coach. They have yet to hire a replacement. Greg Raymond stepped down as Hobart's head coach. Once again, they have not yet hired a replacement. Yale parted ways with defense coordinator Ed Williams. They have not yet hired a replacement. Delaware assistant Matt Rakowski stepped down. We already talked about Jordan Stevens taking leave from Cornell. And then more recently, Kip Turner stepped down at Virginia. And with the exception of the subsequent replacements that I've already noted, all of those jobs remain open. Nick, one of the things that a couple of folks have brought to me is whether or not this trend of guys leaving the profession, like, it's been framed as a what's going on. And if you've listened to this podcast, you know that I react to these things very conservatively. First of all, we're talking about 4 or 5 individuals. I think that's pretty much the normal number. I think that this year you can make an argument that because it's Cornell, the, you know, defending champs, Virginia, as well as Delaware and Hobart, that maybe the programs are a little bit more high profile than they sometimes are. But you're somebody who has lived the life of a Division I assistant coach, and I think can pretty acutely explain why, if it's not for you, it's hard to do it for a while. So what do you make of these guys making the decision to prioritize other elements of their lifestyle as opposed to this element of their profession?
I'll answer this question in almost the umbrella encapsulation of working in sports, whether that's a coach, whether that's a full-time media member, whatever it might be, but especially as it relates to a coach, the stresses and what the first 10 years of your career look like are, to put it lightly, daunting. You're not going to make very much money. Say goodbye to any, you know, if you don't have a day one that's along for the ride and invested in it with you, any fall or any spring weekend getaways, nope. Summer, you're right on the recruiting trail, right into fall ball, and then you get a good Christmas. And then guess what? You're right back in it. And I think what a lot of people end up not realizing is they are viewing college coaching through game day coaching. There is nothing better than being a coach on game day. That is 1% of what you are doing on an annual basis. And the amount of administration work, the pay, the long hours, the traveling, particularly on weekends, the everything that goes along with it, it can just wear you down and grind you down. And what for me, like a big crux of stepping away was, even though I stepped away when I was like 26 or 27, and you know, I kind of had a backdoor, kind of a weird, you know, the first coaching gig I ever had was at D1. So I'm not even talking about grinding through D3, D2 to try and make it, to try and get to, you know, whatever program that you've wanted to coach since you were a kid. But I had 1 year, and then I was looking at what the next 10 years looked like. And in the same way that it's in the broadcasting profession, yeah, everybody wants to be the next Al Michaels. Everybody wants to be the next Joe Buck. Guess how many opportunities there are to fill those shoes? Well, you got to wait until somebody leaves. And the person who earned that position, he sure as shit ain't leaving until he has completely exhausted his tenure. Provided things go good and there's, you know, no truly bad stretches where, you know, his tenure would be questioned. But it's just such a difficult life, and the amount of time that you spend away from your family, and especially if you're, you know, kind of getting ready to take the next steps and, you know, you're getting questions from your girlfriend or wife about engagements and families and, you know, what does our life look like? And, you know, a lot of those big life questions have to be answered at some point. And I think that in a lot of situations, the grind of what being a father looks like in the first however many years of your life, not being able to be as present as you'd like, I don't know if there's an easier trade-off for me. So all that's to say is coaching on game day, there is nothing better, but the amount of work that you have to put in to earn coaching on game day is not worth the return. And in a lot of ways, the financial stability of coaches is not worth the return. So I don't blame any coach for stepping away. And it honestly makes me appreciate the coaches that are doubling down and stepping more, you know, more into it. Fantastic job, but it's not for everybody. And I certainly understand why anybody would make the decision to step away, whether it's financial stability, whether it's taking the next steps in life, whether it's being more present for the people that are in your corner. So just know that when a coach steps away, it's pretty easy for you to say, why would you step away from coaching? That's a great gig. You just won the national championship. And I see that and I'm like, man, he's going to have an awesome summer with his family. And this is going to be the greatest summer of his life. So.
Well said, Nick. You've got some focaccia to make. We appreciate your time as always on the Tailgate Podcast. How many people we got coming over today?
Eight total for dinner.
Perfect number. All right, my man, we'll be back next week with more Tailgate Podcasts as we continue to look back at the 2025 season. If you like what you heard, leave a rating, review, tell a friend. And Nick, I love you.
Love you too, Terry.